We're in the series called Hello, My Name Is. Hello. And this series is all about us. If you're new, maybe the whole Bible is unfamiliar to you, and it was to me when I was your age, and that's cool. That's fine. Glad you're here. This series is about us grabbing characters from within Scripture that maybe we're not so familiar with. We all know a little bit about Jesus. We all know a little bit about King David, those sorts of things. So what Johnny wanted to do and his team was grab a handful of characters that we may not know too well because there's incredible things to be learned through them. Today, if you got my text, if you're on our text group, or if you got it on Twitter or Facebook, I sent out the most incredibly awkward thing. I didn't mean to. I read it later and was like, whoa, you're stupid. I wrote, I'm pulling it up. My speaking notes include the words sex, money, and power. If you're interested in any of those things, don't miss HSM this weekend. Nah. Just want to clarify. We're just teaching and talking. So that was not my best tweet ever. And of course, the entire staff retweeted that. Jerks. Today is about those things. And I'm sorry if your mom got that text too. Someone was mad at me earlier about that. She's like, my mom got that text. We don't, come on. And I was like, girl, your mom knows about that. That's how you got here. All right, sorry. All right, we're going to get serious. Swear to God. All right, Judges 13. This really is a weekend that is about those three things, and honestly, it's about those three things because this sex, money, and this power trilogy, this trinity of temptation, you're caught up in something there. You're probably, if you were going to be honest this morning, one of your greatest weaknesses, one of your greatest temptations, it either revolves around some version of sexuality, some version of power or popularity, or the pursuit of things, money. I'm honestly going to hone in on one in particular. I've got a really unique approach to this morning. After last night, I was like, what was that? It was a good time. Judges 13 is where we're going to be. There was a girl that came up to me. I was standing right over there, and that was 2 years ago. She came up to me. She graduated out of our ministry. She was visiting this weekend with a friend, so she's a sophomore in college 2 years ago. So this is her senior year. Anyways, standing there after high school service, after I'd talked about sex, which is always interesting because I'm 35. Wow, that's hard. You're 15, so that can be awkward, not as awkward as your sixth grade science teacher, so I've got that going for me. And she said to me this after hearing me talk. She said with the like crystal, kind of like tears in her eyes, real heartfelt, she looked up at me and she said, I wish that you had talked about this more when I was in high school. And so much story was packed into that sentence. What was she saying? She so desperately needed to hear that 4 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever it was. And my heart just was like, oh, like wow. And so I'm thinking this morning that there could be some things for us. There are certainly some things for us, myself included, to come away from this morning and let the Lord just say whatever he wants to say. And I know we're in mixed company and some of you are skeptics, and right on, I'm stoked that you're here. I was a total skeptic when I was your age. So maybe you would just have an attitude, like a posture of, all right, maybe there's something to this. And the rest of us, remember last week I had this sermon illustration where I just said, man, maybe you're in with Jesus. You said yes and you're a Christian, the follower, la, 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 la. You've been baptized and the whole thing, but you still are clenching to a couple things, maybe just one that you won't give to him. So all that, I want to lay all that out as we judge. Judges 13 speaks to us. We're going to hit four chapters. I don't know if you put that slide up. I'm not going to read all four. I'm actually going to read less than I did last night because I went 17 minutes over, and I promise you I will not do that. Judges chapter 13, verse 1, it says this. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So God's people, the Israelites at the time, did evil in the eyes of the Lord because he sees everything. So here's what the Lord did. He delivered them into the hands of their enemies, the Philistines, for 40 years. So a certain man of Zorah named Manoah from the clan of the Danites had a wife. So this guy had a wife who had no kids. She was unable to give birth. The angel of the Lord appeared to her and said, you are barren and childless, but you are going to become pregnant and give birth to a son. Now, see to it that you drink no wine or other fermented drink and that you do not eat anything unclean. You will become pregnant and have a son whose head is never to be touched by a razor. That's awkward. I'll explain it. Because here's why: the boy is to be a Nazarite, dedicated to God from the womb. He, this coming baby that's not even in her belly yet, will take the lead in delivering Israel from the hands of the Philistines. What a cool, cool story starting out. This kid's got potential. His name's going to be Samuel. Angel comes and says, hey, here's the deal. You're going to get pregnant. You haven't been able to do that thus far. Promise, baby's coming. And she goes, I don't know if you got the right girl. She must be thinking, I don't know. We've had some struggles. My wife and I had the same struggle, and that's why Gavin's middle name is Samuel. Aww. And so when she got pregnant, it was like 3 a.m, she slapped me, and she's like, I'm pregnant! And I was like, that's great. Liar! You know, it was unbelievable. And so Gavin, his head has been touched by a razor, but I think the Lord used his head to do something. Anyway, that's an inside joke. Kid's got a big head. I wonder if there's a connection. So here comes this baby. He's going to take the lead in delivering Israel from the hands of the Philistines. I want to skip the rest of 13. Some incredible stuff happens that I'd love for you to read on your own. Chapter 14, he's older now. He's about to get married. He's been born, and now here he comes in verse 1. Samson went down to Timnah and saw there a young Philistine woman. Who are the Philistines? Enemies. This is the Juliet Romeo romance part one. All right, you got the Montagues and the Capulets. Same kind of thing, same story. He sees this girl and he says, when he returned, I love this, he said to his father and his mother, he goes home to his mom and dad after seeing the girl and he goes, I have seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now, get her for me as my wife. It's so interesting. Like, I'm trying to picture this conversation. Like, what if you went home today? You're like, Mother, I've seen a young woman from Highland. Get her for me as my wife. It'd just be awkward. And if your mom, like, graduated from Gilbert High, she'd be like, mm-mm, no. You go get you a tiger, all right? We don't date those hawks, all right? I'm not advocating any rivalry or any fights at volleyball games again. Stop that. All right. His father and mother replied, this is awkward, isn't there an acceptable woman among your relatives or among all our people? Socially acceptable at the time. The water wasn't so muddy at the time. So anyway, they're like, don't you have any cousins or anything that would be better than that girl? Must you go to the uncircumcised Philistines to get a wife? But Samson said to his father, he's in love, right? Get her for me. She's the right one for me. Now here's the crazy unfolding of God. He's doing something sovereign. His parents did not know that this was from the Lord, who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines. For at that time, they were ruling over Israel. All right, so there's some dating advice here. What he doesn't know is that his disobedience, God is actually going to use it, leverage it, and redeem it. He's not acting in accordance with the things he should be doing. And the parentheses say, look, he's about to make a bunch of bad decisions, but God's going to use it anyways. This isn't permission for you to go just be an idiot, because God's going to use my idiocy. Like, this is just God going, I know what this kid's going to do before he does it, and I'm going to use it to free my people. But he's about to date this girl that he shouldn't date. None of you know anything about that. Everyone can see that she's the wrong girl but him, but he's just got the blinders. You've had him, right? I don't want to unpack your heart that much this morning, but he has love in his eyes for this girl, and he will not listen to good reason. He is distracted by her. He is mesmerized. He is lovesick. He's obsessed by this girl. And it doesn't matter that she's one of them. He's like, no, you're my girl. Go get her, Dad. It doesn't say mom. He's like, Dad, she won't listen. Please go get this girl. So here's how it all unfolds. And I want to skip this part because it takes a while to read, but I can explain it in brief. They get together. She's a bad girl. He's got mad strength, okay? So he is able to do some incredible things. His hair is somehow connected to that. So you hear about Samson, and he's always got like 8 dreads coming down. That comes from Numbers chapter 6. Numbers chapter 6, it lays out the Nazarite vow. The Nazarite vow included things like you're not going to touch certain things, you're going to give all these things away, and all of this is a special vow before God that you make typically as an adult to say to God, I'm giving you all this, and I'm saying no to all this, even good things, say yes to you supremely. Now him, this is unique because he was not a man. He was a baby when he became a Nazarite. God goes, from the womb, never shave his head because that's going to be a marker, a sign. You're going to be marked by your pretty hair. And somehow he understands that his long Brad Pitt dreads are a sign and really connected to this vow and this strength. That's important. So he understands that his hair is sacred in a way. For him, it's sacred. And so she starts to wonder, this girl that he's getting together with, like, what's your deal? How do you do all the things you do? And he's such a pansy that I'm going to see him one day, and he's going to, pansy, ah! But he has this girl, and she, in three different scenarios, tries to get the information out of him about how he has this crazy strength. Because she's a Philistine, and her people, her cousins and uncles and all these guys are like, you got to tell us how he's got that much strength. We want to kill him. We want to subdue him. So figure it out, because he keeps clowning us. Every time we try to pin him down, he gets away, or he's too strong. And so she's like, I'll try. And so this crazy riddle is unfolded, and he tells this riddle, and she goes and rats out like the details on the riddle. He gets really mad at her. That's such a cropped version of what happened. But he has this riddle, and she finally gets the information out of him about what the riddle means, and he sets up this deal. He's already set up this deal with his enemies, like, if you can figure out my riddle, you can have a bunch of stuff. And so they like get her to get the riddle answered. That's my worst explanation of biblical narrative ever, but the important thing is, eventually, she gets him to say what he does not want to say. She gets him to do what he does not want to do. And she does it by nagging. Like, she just goes on and on and on and on and on and won't leave him alone. And so finally he spills the beans, says everything that he shouldn't have said, and it goes down bad. He has to give up a bunch of stuff. He has to give all these guys, these 30 men, a bunch of things that he lost. And he's super mad about it. Verse 20 of 14, and Samson's wife, it says, was given to one of his companions who had attended him at the feast. Let me unpack that for a moment. It's confusing. He goes down, gets all the stuff that he lost in the bet. While he's gone, she's sitting there like, what have I done? Realizing she's betrayed her man, she feels like he's going to hate me forever. We're breaking up now. Relationship's got to be over. But he fumes. And in his anger, he goes down because of this girl, takes revenge and does this slaughtering. He just butchers some people. Comes back looking for his girl. But it says, while he was gone, his wife was given to his best man. This is a nasty movie unfolding, right? Or at least a country song. Verse 1 of 15. Later on, at the time of wheat harvest, Samson took a young goat and went to visit his wife. He said, I'm going to my wife's room. Uh-oh. But her father would not let him go in. He said, I was so sure you hated her, father of the year, that I gave her to your companion. Hey, look, isn't her younger sister more attractive? Take her instead. Let that sink in, girls. Like, you've had a rough one, and your dad goes, hey, yeah, she's taken now. I thought you were going to be done with her, but check out her little sister. Isn't she pretty? This is a messed up situation. Now, Samson's lost his girl in this moment. He's going to have some girl trouble coming his way, all heading somewhere. This boy has lust problems, but now he's got some anger problems. Verse 3, Samson said to them, this time, I have a right to get even with the Philistines. I will really harm them. So he went out and caught 300 foxes and tied them tail to tail in pairs. He then fastened a torch to every pair of tails, lit the torches, and let the foxes loose in the standing grain of the Philistines. He burned up the shocks and standing grain together with the vineyards and olive groves. When the Philistines asked, who did this? They were told, Samson the Timnite's son-in-law, because his wife was given to his companion. So the Philistines went up and burned her and her father to death. Samson said to them, all right, let's do this. Since you've acted like this, I swear that I won't stop until I get my revenge on you. Crazy story, it's unfolding. Angry, overly sexed man. He is absolutely hung up on revenge and anger. So the next scene that maybe you saw or heard, or there was a coloring book of it, I don't know, in Sunday school, he goes and grabs a jawbone of a donkey and goes to town on all of his enemies. It's like Braveheart mixed in with like The Notebook. It's just, he goes, because it's not in my notes, he goes crazy. He has no self-control. But the guys in the room, something has tapped into us. Like, the Cardinals are going to be 8-1 today. We love to watch men smash into each other, right? There's something in us that's like, yeah, girls don't get boxing. Most girls don't get UFC. But boys were like, there's something right about this. There's something right about that man bleeding. There is, weird. And ladies, this is why you're the supreme supremacy of creation. We're still down here like, hit him. Right? So you got something in you that's like, whoa, get him, get him, get him, get him, get him. He goes down, and this ends with him essentially winning. It says the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and boom, he just knocks everyone down with a donkey's jawbone. Crazy. Verse 20 of chapter 15 says, Samson led Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistine. Okay, so rough past, but right on. You had a 20-year tenure. 20 years of getting it right. 20 years in one sentence, they don't include anything. They're like, right on, he did it. He led Israel. For 20 years, seems like a happy ending. Man, 20 years, he's building this legacy. He's building this reputation, and then one day, verse 1, 16, Samson went to Gaza, where he saw a prostitute. He went in to spend the night with her. It just took him one night. It took him one night to take 20 years. It took him one decision, one weak moment to take 20 years of what God had been doing in his life and put it to an end. Essentially, in his life, he had one moment. He had 20 years of just some good leadership, and then all of a sudden, because he had no self-control, he had no plan in place, he put himself in a situation where he was tempted. I mean, he put himself out there. This is all of us need to listen to this. He put himself in a situation where he knows his weakness, he knows he struggles here, he knows he loves the ladies more than he should, right? And then he puts himself in the presence of a prostitute. This guy can't handle that. Like, some of us would see that and go, oh my gosh, that poor girl, we need to give, you know, like, get her a jacket. But he's not that guy. He sees her and goes, I'm in, let's do this. And he hooks up with her in verse 1. Verse 4 to 5, it gets a little crazy. It's been like three verses, and here comes another girl. Sometime later, he fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. The rulers of the Philistines went to her. Here they come again. They go to the next girl and they say, see if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so we may tie him up and subdue him. Each one of us will give you 1,100 shekels. So this is kind of a crazy story. I'm going to skip to 16. I gave you the sort of the backdrop on it already. With such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was sick to death of it. Verse 17, so he told her everything. This dude. Verse 21, how the story sort of ends for him. 16, verse 21, it says, then the Philistines grabbed him, because it worked, gouged out his eyes, and took him down to Gaza. Nothing good happens in Gaza for this guy. Binding him with bronze shackles, they set him to grinding grain in the prison. But the hair on his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. Verse 25, while these guys, his enemies, were still in high spirits, they shouted, bring out Samson to entertain us. So they called Samson out of the prison, and he performed for them. They bring him out with no eyes, put him in front of the crowd, and say, hey, dance, monkey. Like, they want him to just put on a show for them. This is a pitiful end of his life. Like, it's a sad moment, because this story unfolds with this guy, Samson. He's like, hey, I know the room's crowded. I'm tired. Can you just put me over by the load-bearing beams here? So the picture is this moment. He has a little bit of hair popping through, and he goes, hey, can you just put me over by those pillars? And the story unfolds with this guy grabbing a couple of pillars that are holding up the ceiling that is above hundreds of his enemies, squeezes them hard enough that the ceiling comes collapsing in, kills them, kills him, kills everyone. But when the dust settles, Samson's dead. Samson's gone. He suicide bombs the Philistines. And when the dust settles, he's dead and the Philistines are still in control. Like, his little act was bloody, and he probably felt good about taking out his enemies, but that wasn't the life that he could have had. I look at this guy and I go, man, if it wasn't for sex and revenge in your life, what could have been? If it wasn't for sex and revenge, what could have been? Those two things. If it wasn't for your sexuality that just got out of control, and this propensity, this desire, this must for revenge, what could have been in your life? Now, you need to hear me. Listen, I have struggled with both of these more than you have. I'm going to put it out there. I won't tell you my whole story because I got a mic on and your parents listen, but I'm just saying, you and I, we're on even ground on this. My high school and college years pre-Jesus were unbelievably defined by these two things. So I don't come at you like some preacher. I don't sit up here today judging you, condemning you. I'm actually going to read something that I starkly disagree with that was written by a young woman. And as I read this, I'm going to read the whole thing. I printed the blog that has gotten more attention than most blogs ever do. This girl blew up social media. I want to talk for just a few minutes about this young woman's understanding of sexuality. The reason I'm going to is because you've probably read this article. You've probably heard this. Her name is Samantha Pugsley, and she wrote an article that just blew up, meaning it got more likes and retweets and favorites and comments than most people ever will in their lifetime. Like, I got like 500 retweets the other day on this thing I said, and I was like, I'm the king of the world. She's hundreds of thousands of clicks, retweets, likes, and then I've got, and here's the impetus, I've got this on my Facebook feed over and over and over again by current and former students going, this sounds right. What she's saying sounds right. And as a pastor, I don't impose my personal convictions on anyone. I don't go, hey, if you're not like me, you're not. I don't do that. But I do get the opportunity to go, hey, let's talk about worldviews. Let's talk about what you think. Let's talk about what the Lord thinks, because I believe he speaks. And so we can talk about that if we need to. Let me read this and stop talking about all that. Samantha Pugsley is, oh, let me stop. If I say something that taps into a kindergarten gene in your heart that makes you want to laugh, I want to read this as though she's going to hear this. She won't. But I want to read this as though she's sitting right here. You know what I mean? So I'm not going to be one of those pastors that says some snarky crap about some woman that I disagree with to make my point. You know what I'm saying? So I'm going to disagree with her as though she's in the room. Cool. All right. So I hope. We'll see. Samantha Pugsley is an English studies graduate, freelance writer, and photographer. She's a married, bisexual, artsy, super nerd, I think that's supposed to be funny, who loves Marvel, fantasy, science fiction, novels, video games, and writing fan fiction, whatever that is. She's incredibly passionate about gender equality, female sexuality, and reproductive rights, as well as mental health reform. As of yesterday at about 3 o'clock when I printed this, it had 3,420 comments. So I didn't leave one because I was like, no one's going to see it. Believing that true love waits, she says. That's a reference to a program that many churches have done over the years called True Love Waits, and all the ladies get a purity ring and say no to sex and tell their husband. That's the program. I wasn't selling that very well, but that's kind of what happens. Believing that true love waits, I make a commitment to God, myself, my family, my friends, my future mate, and my future children to be sexually abstinent from this day until the day I enter biblical marriage relationship, as well as abstaining from sexual thoughts, sexual touching, pornography, and actions that are known to lead to sexual arousal. It's all in quotes, and she says, at the age of 10, I took that pledge at my church alongside a group of other girls to remain a virgin until marriage. Yes, you read that right. I was 10 years old. I'm going to pause and I'm going to comment briefly on a handful of the things she says. Was 10 years old too young? Depends on the 10-year-old. Right? Like, I talk about things in here and I have some freshmen that are like, I know exactly what you're talking about. And then I have some freshmen that are like, right? Like, so, depending on the kid. But for her, she felt like it was 10 years too young, and she felt manipulated. And so, hey, I hear you. Let's take a look at who I was when I was 10 years old. I was in fourth grade. I played with Barbie dolls and had tea parties with my imaginary friends. I pretended I was a mermaid every time I took a bath. I still thought boys were icky. They are. And I had no idea I liked girls, too. I wouldn't get my period for another 4 years. And most importantly, I didn't have a clue about sex. So argument is, what are you talking about? She said yes to something that she had no idea what she was saying yes to. So in her defense, I'm like, right on. I understand. That could be perceived as manipulative. So this is a moment for me to just go, hey, I never want to manipulate you. Some of you will say yes to whatever I say yes to, or Johnny says yes to, or your small group says yes to. We're like, no, check your brain at the door. But for this girl, she felt like it was too young. 4 years from then, she's going to have her first sort of interaction with all this. And the church taught me, her church, not the church. The church taught me that sex was for married people. Extramarital sex was sinful and dirty, and I would go to hell if I did it. I learned that as a girl, I had a responsibility to my future husband to remain pure for him. it was entirely possible that my future husband wouldn't remain pure for me because he didn't have that same responsibility, she says, according to the Bible. And of course, because I was a Christian, I would forgive him for his past sins and his transgressions, she says, and fully give myself to him, body and soul. She said, I would go to hell if I did it. I don't know what tradition she's from, but that's not in the Bible. I don't know what her small group leader said, or her pastor said, or her youth pastor said, or her parents said, but the idea that this woman, if she made some sort of moral mistake, would be cast out for all time by God, that he, in his impatience, would go, I'm done. I'm done. You're impure, and I'm holy. Get. That's the opposite of the gospel. That's the opposite of everything you see Jesus say. And so this idea, no wonder she wanted nothing to do with him. Why would she? If her idea is of this massive God who in one moment or maybe two would send someone to an eternal hell for a finite, finite mistake. Where's the grace? I'm reading this going, this guy, how many likes, how many views, and how many you goes? This is the perception people have of the church. This poor girl did. If she was here, I'd go, I wish you went to my group. I'm selfish that way. I'm a little jealous. Not that I'm getting everything right, but I would never let you think that God's love is that small. Anyway, all right, I wasn't supposed to talk that much. Oh, let me point this one out. According to the Bible, men don't have the same responsibility. What are you talking? I was not going to say what you think I was going to say. Listen, all right, I don't want you to get distracted by my process of sanctification that's still unfolding. I was not going to say what you think I was going to say, by the way. I was going to say frick, but it doesn't matter. Men, I'm going to assume no one's going to get married one day and treat the Bible like a weapon. I'm going to assume one day that none of you will ever do this kind of nonsense. Here's why. There was a girl here last night, and she told me the story of how her stepdad is using the Bible to control her mom. I'm reading this blog, I'm reading this thing, and I'm hearing that girl's story, and I'm going, you gotta be kidding me. That there are some wolves, some men, who put on the mask of Christian and put it on their Facebook or whatever they may do, but then they will open the Bible and use it as a weapon to control women and to get what they want from them. My only problem with that is the Apostle Paul, who said, husbands, you should love your wives the way that Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. What does a husband do with that verse when he's demanding sex? What does a husband do with that verse when he's condoning his own sin but pointing hers out? What does a husband do in that moment when God himself sent his son to be massacred on a cross willingly for the joy set before Jesus, he endured the cross? That's a good relationship. You want to sign up for that one. You're wondering if Jesus loves you? He said, for the joy, I'm going to go endure this cross so you don't have to. Husbands, love your wives the way I did that on the cross. Do the laundry at least, right? Clean up, respect her, be considerate of her. But her idea is that her future husband's allowed to be a slut because the Bible says so? What? Where? Where does the Bible give permission for men to sin willingly while women serve? I didn't see it, I've read it. Sorry, I'm mad. Once I got married, it would be my duty to fulfill my husband's sexual needs. I was told over and over again, so many times I lost count, that if I remained pure, my marriage would be blessed by God. And if I didn't, that it would fall apart and end in tragic divorce. That it would be blessed? Like what? This is such a works-based system she's signing up for, that God will bless her marriage if she does her part, but otherwise he's going to curse it if she doesn't give it up. What? All of this is such a misperception. She has no idea the beauty and the grace of the gospel, and it doesn't get any better. I believed it. She said, why wouldn't I? I was young, and these were people I trusted. So her youth group, she's like, I trust all you. Everyone knew I'd taken the virginity vow, of course. So everyone's talking about her. Gossip, she says, is the lifeblood of the Baptist church. I think that's an unfair stab at the Baptist church, but in her experience, gossip was enough to push her away from Jesus. Like, you think that words don't matter. Words in this girl's story pushed her so far away. I'm going to keep going. For more than a decade, I wore my virginity like a badge of honor. My church encouraged me to do so, saying my testimony would inspire other young girls to follow suit. If the topic ever came up in conversation, I was happy to let people know that I had taken a pledge of purity. It became my entire identity by the time I hit my teen years. When I met my then boyfriend, now husband, I told him right away that I was saving myself for marriage, and he was fine with that because it was my body, my choice, and he loved me. That's incredible. We were together for 6 years before we got married. Anytime we did anything remotely sexual, guilt overwhelmed me. I wondered where the line was, a lot of you guys ask, I wondered where the line was because I was terrified to cross it. Was he allowed to touch my breasts? Could we look at each other naked? I didn't know what was considered sexual enough to condemn my future marriage and send me straight to hell. Two things. God, yes, has set up parameters and borders and boundaries in your sexual life. He did that because he loves you. I'm going to unpack that a little bit at the end. So there is a line that you shouldn't cross. That's beautiful. That's good news for you. Fellas, if you are going to be a spiritual leader in your home one day, start today and never ask her to cross any line she said no to, no matter how long you've been dating, because the trajectory of hand-holding and kissing goes somewhere. And so as the man in the relationship, you say, I'm not going to make you draw the line. I'm going to draw the line and honor you. Man, I could go off on that one. But we don't put it on the ladies to set the boundaries. We say, I'm going to honor you, and I'm going to honor you, and I don't know if I'm going to be your future husband. Maybe not say that, because right, everyone thinks it's going to happen, but you're thinking, I'm going to honor your future husband because you actually belong to him in the future. He's there somewhere waiting. I ain't him, maybe. You're his. All right, so I'm preaching, but this girl's got all sorts of guilt. I don't know if it was guilt like God hates me or guilt like this is wrong. The guilt that God hates me is wrong. That's just untrue. But the feeling of sorrow, maybe, and man, this isn't right, that couldn't be the Holy Spirit nudging. An unhealthy mixture of pride, fear, and guilt helped me keep my pledge until we got married. In the weeks before our wedding, I often got congratulated on keeping my virginity for so long. The comments ranged from curious, how in the world did you manage, to downright, like, disgusting. Someone said, I bet you're going to have one busy wedding night. Gosh, that's awkward. I let them place me on the pedestal as their virginal, perfect Christian girl mascot. I lost my virginity on my wedding night with my husband, just as I had promised that day when I was 10 years old. I stood in the hotel bathroom beforehand wearing my white lingerie thinking I made it, I'm a good Christian. There was no chorus of angels, no shining light from heaven. It was just me and my husband in a dark room, fumbling with a condom and a bottle of lube for the first time. Sorry if that's awkward for you. Speaking of awkward, your wedding night, I've said this before, I just give you permission to just have the most awkward night of your life. I don't know how to say this to you. The ideal, the intention, there's a distortion, but the intention is that it will be. The intention behind the whole thing is that you walk in going, I don't know, let's figure this out. I feel awkward, very awkward. Me too, fantastic. Right? It's okay. You may laugh on your wedding night. You may just go, what the heck was that? My bad. All right, let's try again. Okay? And then here's the thing. Oh, I have never been angrier or meaner than one day. I was on this stage, and there was a little boy. And he, so I'm not going to point at a real kid. Let's say he was in that empty chair over there. He was sitting over there. He'd been coming to my youth group for years, and I shouldn't use real examples like this. Just letting God stop me if he wants. Listen, this girl felt vulnerable. And she felt like that night, probably she had to perform. She had to impress him. If you feel like one day, I'm talking to the girls, fellas too, yeah. If you feel like one day, you better be really good at this to get him or her to love you, like get out of that relationship. Like if you feel like you one day are gonna be that vulnerable with someone, and they're going to, like, judge you and give you, like, a 1 to 10, like, subconsciously, you have entered into a performance-based relationship. And you have said, look, I'm gonna stick around as long as you're good, and as long as this is great, or I'm gonna go find a better thing. And I'm just going, that's such a distortion of what marriage is supposed to be. And I just think how much heartbreak you're gonna experience, because you're gonna have guys going, hey, I can get you ready for that day. Hey, you don't wanna walk into that day unprepared. Freaking wolf. Like that kind of talk, that kind of idea, the grace that God intended within a marriage, within a wedding night and everything that follows after, it allows for, I don't know what I'm doing, and I feel insecure, and I feel broken, and I feel like you don't really love me, and that's an opportunity for the gospel to be put on display when the husband and the wife love each other despite their imperfections, with the imperfections. And so this girl stumbling around, she immediately knew, I'm not good enough. Watch what happens. Sex hurt, she said. I knew it would. Everyone told me it would be uncomfortable the first time. What they didn't tell me is that I would be back in the bathroom afterwards crying quietly for reasons I didn't yet comprehend. They didn't tell me that I'd be on my honeymoon crying again because sex felt dirty and wrong and sinful, even though I was married and it was supposed to be okay now. When we got home, I couldn't look anyone in the eye. Everyone knew my virginity was gone. My parents, my church, my friends, my coworkers, they all knew I was soiled and tarnished. Soiled and tarnished? I wasn't special anymore. My virginity had become such an essential part of my personality that I didn't know who I was without it. Her identity should have been as the beloved of Christ, not some thing she's held on to, right? It didn't get any better. I avoided undressing in front of my husband. I tried not to kiss him too often or too sensually, she says, so I wouldn't lead him on. I dreaded bedtime. Maybe he'd want to have sex. When he did, I obliged. I wanted nothing more than to make him happy because I loved him so much and because I'd been taught that it was my duty to fulfill his needs. But I hated sex. Sometimes I cried myself to sleep because I wanted to like it, because it wasn't fair. I'd done everything right. I took the pledge and stayed true to it. Where was this blessed marriage I was promised? I let it go on this way for almost 2 years before I broke down. I just couldn't do it anymore. I told my husband everything. My feminist husband was horrified, I love it, that I'd let him touch me when I didn't want him to. He made me promise. This is a good move on this dude's part. He made me promise I'd never do anything I didn't want to do ever again. We stopped having sex. He encouraged me to see a therapist, and I did, and it was the first step on a long journey to what she calls healing. 10-year-old girls want to believe fairy tales. Take this pledge, and God will love you so much and be so proud of you, they told me. If you want to wait until I have sex until marriage, God will bring you a wonderful Christian husband, and you'll get married and live happily ever after, they said. Waiting didn't give me a happily ever after. Instead, it controlled my identity for over a decade, landed me in therapy, and left me a stranger in my own skin. I was so completely ashamed of my body and my sexuality that it made having sex a demoralizing experience. I don't go to church anymore, nor am I religious. As I started to heal, I realized that I couldn't figure out how to be both religious and sexual at the same time, so I chose sex. Every single day is a battle to remember that my body belongs to me and not to the church of my childhood. I have to constantly remind myself that a pledge I took when I was only 10 doesn't define who I am today. When I have sex with my husband, I make sure it's because I have a sexual need and not because I feel like I'm required to fulfill his desires. I'm now thoroughly convinced that the entire concept of virginity is used to control female sexuality. If I could go back, I would not wait. I would have sex with my then boyfriend, now husband, and I wouldn't go to hell for it. We would have gotten married at a more appropriate age, and I would have kept my sexuality to myself. Fortunately, I can't go back, but I can give you this message as a culmination of my experiences. If you want to wait to have sex until marriage, make sure it's because you want to. It's your body, it belongs to you, not your church. Your sexuality is nobody's business but yours. Go. Okay. I'm over on time. That's not the gospel. That is not the best God could come up with. Ladies, I sat in on a planning session with this Transformed conference last week. If you missed that, my heart breaks for you. I sat in there and I just went, oh, this is so good. I'm critical. I think a lot of things churches do suck. I'm like, that's your best? Skip that. Don't skip this. Oh. Fellas, this is so hard for you. It is such a battle for you to remain pure. Where the fellas in the room, ladies, we're so visually wired, so physically oriented, that we would love some, I'm not putting this responsibility on you because men step up, but we could use all the help we can get, guarding our eyes and our hearts, trying to stay pure. Man, there's so much to this. Here's the one thing I want to leave you with. Samson couldn't get it right. I pray that you would. When God sets up boundaries, some people walk away from the church because they're like, you can't control me. When God sets up, says yes to these things and no to these things, what I've learned is that he lets me choose and he constantly lets me turn back around again if I make the wrong choice. He's just in the business of second chances. So I made 21 years plus of horrible decisions in this conversation. I was just a modern day Samson minus the muscle, clearly. But now I get to go, well, this is a unique, distinct blessing of my own to stand in front of you, to open God's word, and to even just let a young lady speak through her blog and go, there are two worldviews presented to you today. One is of a God who has given you a gift of your sexuality. You're not an animal and you're not an angel. You're neither one of those things. You have a gift of your sexuality. And he will let you choose to either trust him with it and to understand that he knows best, or choose on your own. This young lady had such a distorted view of sexuality, taught to her by pastors potentially or people that had no idea what the gospel looks like or that God actually does care about the whole person, including their sexuality. She was handed lies and she believed them. She walked away from the church because she should have. I said that last week and I'm saying it again. She left that church. I sure wish she'd come to this one or about 1,000 others I know that would tell her that God is not so uncreative that he went, oh Lord, what have we done? Make it wicked, make it evil, make it, scare them, scare the kids. We gotta scare them away from sex. Like, right, is that what we're trying to do? I'm trying to tell you, you got something so beautiful and you have a God who is fighting for your joy. And he's fighting for your marriage when he says to you, hey, here's some boundaries. I'll let you jump the fence if you want to, but I promise you, my boundaries are set up so that you will experience life and life to the full. You get to unpack this on Wednesday night in your house groups. You get to be honest if you want to. And if you gossip after Wednesday night, don't come the next Wednesday until you and I have a chat. Cool? All right, I scared the hell out of you there, didn't I? Do not take someone's secrets and precious this and go, did you hear about this girl? We need to pray for her. Mm-mm. Kill that. Come Wednesday, actually. I'm tripping. You're coming to the Transform Conference, ladies. Fellows, go to your houses. Those aren't canceled. I'm going to pray for you and let you go to lunch. I love you. So, Father, I pray for that young woman who blogged that. She's as loved by you as I am and anyone in this room. She's made in your image. She's precious to you. She hasn't blogged enough to send you off. Your love for her is constant. Your plan for her is redeemable. She has opinions maybe I disagree with, but I'd look at her and I'd go, the gospel's better than that. The good news is actually better than that. And so I just pray that you would do the convincing. I didn't. I pray that you would open hearts, open minds, convince us that your way is better. You're not trying to control us. You're trying to set us free to live life the way you intended. In Jesus' name, amen.